Dear Dhamma friends, we have come to the next item of this mindfulness for young adults session, and that is actually a discussion on Kaggavisana Sutta. These days we are discussing Kaggavisana Sutta, and Kaggavisana Sutta, as we all can remember, is available in Sutta Nipata. Sutta Nipata being available in the Kuddaka Nikaya, those are the shorter discourses of the Buddha, and there are one important book is called Sutta Nipata, and very interesting suttas like Mangala Sutta, Ratana Sutta, Kaggavisana Sutta, Haraniyametta Sutta. So those suttas are actually all in the Sutta Nipata, and all teachings, very ancient teachings are there, and sometimes Buddha himself has given further commentary to these certain suttas. Certain questions are there, questioned by various ascetics, Brahmins, and Buddha given certain answers to them. And later, during his lifetime, he has referred on this particular occasion, I have given an answer in this Parayana Magga available in Sutta Nipata. So likewise, he has referred this Sutta Nipata sometimes. So therefore, we can understand the very authentic teachings are there in the Sutta Nipata. And Kaggavisana Sutta is one of them, and quite interesting one. Basically, explains how a secluded practice is important, and particularly these verses available in the Sutta Nipata, this Kaggavisana Sutta are attributed to Paccheka Buddhas. Paccheka Buddhas are particularly interested in secluded practice because they are not establishing an order, the Sangha order. Rather, they live alone, maybe with several other Paccheka Buddhas, but doesn't involve in the typical establishment of sasana and developing monasteries or any of those. But they like to live alone, secluded practice, and that is their most interest. So therefore, the theme of this sutta we can recognize as the secluded practice. And it is not only related to the Paccheka Buddhas, but time to time, ourselves also have to involve with certain amount of secluded practice. It doesn't mean that we are completely disengaged from the society and completely live alone or leave the house. That doesn't mean either, because the real practice happens when we are going through certain difficulties, certain challenges. And that is also there. That is also another attribute of our practice. But having some seclusion during our day's time is also important. So both sides have to go hand in hand. Kind of a balance has to be maintained. So in this particular verse, a particular Paccheka Buddha, so he basically explains how he attained Paccheka Buddhahood by giving certain aspects of the Dhamma. So he has attained Paccheka Buddhahood, and then he explained certain aspects of the Dhamma. So according to the commentary, these aspects are quite actually what our Buddha has mentioned. And in many other suttas, many suttas explained by the Buddha, Sammasambuddha, so these dhammas, so these aspects of the verse are well explained. So if we go to the verse, Patisallanam jhanam arinchamanu dhammesu nichyam anudhammachari adinavam sammasitha bhavesu ekochare kaggavisana kappu. Patisallanam jhanam arinchamanu. So this Patisallana. So note this. So Patisallana is another word for seclusion. And jhanam is, is the jhana, arinjamanu, not neglecting. So this particular person, this particular Paccheka Buddha, he is not neglecting the jhana and the seclusion. So particularly he is interested in the development of samatha, development of vipassana, and being in that attainment or enjoying that attainment. So that is something explained here. And then dhammesu nicchang anudhammachari. And always he is in accordance with the teachings. And adinavang sammasita bhavesu. So different existence are there, maybe the different realms. And again, if in the subtle sense, different becomings. And he understands the dangers in those becomings. Eko chare kagga visana kappu. One lives alone like a rhinoceros. If we go a little detail to this verse, so there are some aspects of Dhamma we can understand. Patisallana. So one aspect is the seclusion. Where Buddha explained this having patisallana, being little away from the house, away from the relatives, away from the children, away from the wife, away from the husband, away from the other friends, other people, and find kind of a seclusion. So there are actually, we can recognize three types of seclusion here. Kaya viveka, chitta viveka, and upadhi viveka, where one has bodily seclusion, one has seclusion from the various hindrances, and again one has seclusion away from all the defilements. So it's a different levels of seclusion we are talking here. So maintaining bodily seclusion is not a big thing in a way. So if you can simply go away from your house for some times, you are going for a retreat, you are going for a little remote area, so you can have the bodily seclusion. But that is not the most important thing. How to have mind seclusion? How to keep your mind free from various hindrances? And most importantly, how to keep the mind free from defilements? That is the upadhi viveka. So these are the aspects we can understand from Buddha's teaching. So different ways Buddha in how to achieve this proper type of solitude. Now here, not neglecting seclusion and the jhana. So particularly here one can say jhana indicates the samatha practices. So Pacheka Buddha seems are enjoying the samatha practices and they attain jhana and they are not neglecting jhana. So assume that someone attained Pacheka Buddhahood without jhana. So probably he may even develop jhana in order to have kind of a seclusion, secluded practice. That is what mentioned in the commentary. And don't know whether like Samma Sambuddha, when someone become a Samma Sambuddha, actually everything is available. So Samma Sambuddha is a special situation where he has all the best levels of the samatha practice as well as the best levels of the vipassana practice. But the arahants may be different. Certain arahants may have certain amount of samatha practice, samatha skills, and they have vipassana skills. Some certain arahants may not have samatha skills, but they may have vipassana skills. So it depends, it varies. So Pacheka Buddhahood also probably might varying, not very clear. And then Dhammesu Nichang Anudhammachari. So there are something that we can learn. Always he is following the Dhamma. He is always in accordance with the teachings. So what are these teachings? So that is something that we can learn. So Buddha has explained his teaching in more practical sense as he is getting older. So if you refer certain suttas available in the Digha Nikaya, particularly the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, certain account of incidents happened during the last part of the Buddha's life is included in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. So Buddha again and again highlights certain skills one needs to develop. So the first skill, actually these are known as 37 Bodhipakkhiya Dhammas. So the first part comes as the Chattaro Satipatthana, four foundations of mindfulness. So you are familiar with these things. That is the foundations of the foundation on the body, Kaya Anupassana, foundation on the feelings, Vedana Anupassana, foundation on various mind states, we can say, mental states, cittanupassana, and the mindfulness on various phenomena, that is dhammanupassana. So these are essential parts. So one has to have essentially developed these skills. And again, the most convenient place to start is again the body awareness or the mindfulness based on the body. So that is something someone can start with. But later as he grow, so his practice may further expand and he may develop even mindfulness on feelings, and even he may get on to the realm of the mind. Yeah, he understand various mind states, various thoughts. So he do some sort of exploration of his own mind. And then certain other way, another type Buddha explained is the four bases of spiritual power, what we call as Chattaro Iddipada. So when one develops one's spiritual path, there may be certain aspects one is keeping as a kind of a base. Say for example, certain people are quite strong in their effortful people. So they never give up. There may be various obstacles come on their way, but they are very effortful. Even if they collapse, still they quickly get up. So always having relentless kind of an effort, quite effortful. So therefore this is something that we are keeping as our base. Certain people are quite energetic. So that is called virya, virya iddipada. Certain people keep virya effort as their one strong point, strong skill, based on which they are able to overcome all different types of obstacles. Certain others are quite determined. So they are quite determined to achieve something. So that is the determination, what we call as chitta iddipada. And on the other hand, certain others are having kind of a desire. I should achieve this. I should have attained this. I should attain this kind of a spiritual development. So they have kind of a desire. The motivation happens through a kind of a good desire. So desire can be used in both ways. Either one can use desire to sort of destroy oneself, to pollute one's mind, to get on to a kind of a downfall. But on the other hand, if we direct it properly, you can use the same desire to develop oneself. So Chanda Iddipada is something therefore useful, where you have kind of a desire, kind of a motivation happens, and that helps to go step by step in the practice. So the other group is based on the wisdom. So they always want to explore what is realities, what is jhana, what is vipassana, what are these insight knowledges, are they really available, is it possible to practice, am I able to experience. So they have kind of a investigative attitude. So they want to explore, they want to investigate by themselves. So this also helps to drive ourselves, this also helps to continue our practice. So therefore, these are the drives we have, the motivations we have, and those are necessary to continue our practice. So if we don't have any of these, then we may drop in between, we may neglect in between, or we may simply neglect our practice in between, because we haven't keep any of these as our kind of a driving force. And then Chattaro Sammappadhana. There are four kinds of efforts. So as we continue, we need to look at our mind. And are there any defilements present? Or aren't there any defilements? If there are no defilements at all, so we have to have a kind of an effort not to allow unarisen defilements to arise. So that means we need to prolong that purity of mind. At the moment there are no defilements, and let's keep that undefiled mind or pure mind
further. So therefore, he is making an effort not to allow unarisen defilements to arise. So that is a spiritual power. Sorry, spiritual kind of an effort one is maintaining. On the other hand, if there is some situation due to some reason, certain defilements has already arisen in the mind. So you understand, okay, now mind is lustful. So rather than simply neglecting that and allowing the mind to further burn through lust, now one has to have an effort to overcome this lust. So different levels, one may use different techniques. Still, if he is not yet developed in the mindfulness practice, not yet developed enough in the vipassana practice, so he may have to use certain, say, practices useful. Some skillful means useful at that level. Maybe asubha bhavana, recognizing the loathsomeness of the body, recognizing various dangers of the lust. So likewise, certain aspects he can use in order to overcome lustful mind. On the other hand, assume that someone has already developed fair amount of vipassana, but due to some reason, lustful thought has come in the mind. So at that time, he can simply be aware of the lust. He can simply confront lust. He can recognize lust as lust. Without neglecting it, without promoting it, he is mindfully step back and look at lust as lust. So this helps to overcome that lust because you basically has disengaged from lust. You are not promoting it, you are not becoming a victim of it, or you are not supporting it. Rather, you disengage and observe it objectively. This helps to overcome lust, and this is the most advanced method we can in a way say, because this helps to properly understand the characteristics of lust and again to dilute lust. So likewise, overcoming defilements or overcoming various unwholesome states arisen in the mind is another effort. On the other hand, when we consider the wholesome side, so we need to arouse wholesome side, or we need to improve wholesome side. So we can't simply continue our spiritual practice as it is. We need certain amount of skills to be developed. We need to develop mindfulness, we need to develop a fair amount of concentration. And once concentration and mindfulness is available, then we need to develop insight knowledge, so insight practice, vipassana. So certain amount of skillful means that we need to develop, spiritual qualities that we need to develop, and for that you need fair amount of effort. And once you develop some amount of spiritual qualities, we need to protect them. Otherwise, they simply wane. They simply disappear. Start to erode. So therefore, how to protect them? How to further improve them? How to maintain them? How to take them to their maturity, to their completeness? So this is another effort that Buddha talks. So therefore, you can see when we consider four efforts, so this is another kind of a teaching that Buddha explained, and this is quite practical, and we need to use them time to time. And then five faculties. As we develop our practice, certain spiritual qualities become more prominent. So, for example, faith sometimes become more prominent. Sometimes effort become more prominent. So you can recognize, okay, today I'm quite energetic. My mind is quite energetic. I can do anything. I can practice several hours even. I can do walking practice several hours even. I'm quite energetic today. So you can feel that the presence of the effort at that time. And then sometimes mindfulness is quite present, and you can recognize, okay, today from the morning I am maintaining very good mindfulness. Each and every ordinary experience I was maintaining good mindfulness. So likewise, you can recognize the presence of mindfulness. And at that period, you can know, at that day, you can know, okay, mindfulness is quite predominant, quite powerful. And certain other qualities, concentration. Sometimes mind get concentrated and your concentration is very good. and you can go deep concentrated levels. So you recognize on that day or in that particular session, concentration was very powerful. And certain other times, vipassana or the wisdom is powerful, and you can recognize, okay, today I have a very good, say, wisdom. I was able to look at certain things penetratively. I had sharp wisdom. So likewise, the presence of sharp wisdom is able to recognize. So these five faculties, therefore Buddha mentioned, are skills that we need to develop, and you recognize their presence. You understand now the spiritual qualities are available in the mind. Previously, you didn't know even about them. But later, as we continue our practice, we can recognize their presence. And then Pancha Balani. So these spiritual faculties, Indriya, once you develop further, they become spiritual powers. Now you are becoming more confident about your own practice. Rather than previously, you depend on meanings and you always want to refer certain things, you always want to get advice from another person, look after yourself, because still a little bit weak. But later, you develop a fair amount of confidence. Therefore, even when mind is not mindful, in other terms, when mind is unmindful, still you are not shocked by it. You are not disturbed by it because you know how to make it mindful. So you are now quite familiar with the techniques. You are quite competent with the practice. So you know how to handle it quickly. You can re-establish mindfulness. Similarly, if mind is little lethargic, still you are not panic. You know how to arouse energy quite quickly. You can recover quickly. And even when there is no saddha, you know how to arouse saddha. Even when there is no concentration, assume that the mind is restless, still you are not panic, still you are not disturbed because you know I can quickly concentrate the mind. And sometimes you know mind is little ignorant and maybe simply living in the typical surface level, mundane level or conventional level, but still not much shocked or worried because you know quickly you can come to the penetrative knowledge. You can quickly improve your wisdom. So likewise, you are having certain confidence when you come to the level of spiritual powers, for five powers. And then one come across the seven enlightenment factors. So there is a kind of a directional change happens in one's practice. So far actually once one has developed these skills, not yet well oriented towards the say peace, oriented towards the spiritual kind of a peaceful accomplishment, but rather one can use all these different skills even for maybe some mundane type of skills. So you can develop mindfulness, but you can use those skills to have a good family life, maybe to have a good official setup, to continue your job in a more successful manner. So you can use mindfulness. But when one reaches the seven enlightenment factors, when one recognizes that and develop that to some extent, and coming specially to the level of developing enlightenment factors further by associating seclusion, associating cessation, and associating dispassion, associating letting go. So these kind of higher levels of attributes completely turn one's direction of the practice towards the Nibbana. So he is more keen on overcoming defilements, keeping the mind free from defilements, keeping the mind free from attachments, free from grasping, keeping the mind more peaceful, keeping the mind free from any stresses, tension, free from suffering. So likewise, his goal is properly oriented now when one reaches the seven enlightenment factors. And to further develop that, one may use Sila Samadhi Panya, morality. He is further developing his behavior, he's properly refining his behavior, and if necessary, he is developing fair amount of samadhi. And on top of that, one further develops vipassana, wisdom, so that one is able to overcome various defilements. So these anudhammachari, so one maintain one's life accordingly to develop these qualities. This is a kind of a practical path. So one recognize, okay, certain spiritual path is available, and that spiritual path has to be developed. Certain skills have to be developed. So you recognize the presence of those spiritual qualities, understand those spiritual qualities, and you understand their value. And again, how to develop them, how practically to develop them, and how much roughly at least I have developed them. So you have a little bit of a assessment about yourself, and you time to time reflect about your own practice. Come back and see how my mind is behaving. So this is important, because so we ourselves become our teacher. Previously, of course, we get lot of guidance from our teachers, from our, say, books, maybe using various sermons, we get lot of guidance, lot of support. But slowly one develops one's practice, and then one has to have certain amount of confidence in one's own practice. So now one is slowly becoming kind of an independent person. So he recognizes, okay, this is the path. He recognized clearly, okay, this is the path that I need to further develop. Certain areas I am still weak. I have to honestly develop in these areas. These are my skills and these are my weaknesses. And these are the ignorant places that I am still maintaining. So likewise, he do kind of an honest assessment time to time, honest reflection time to time. And accordingly, he do adjustments. He do developments. So therefore, it's a kind of a continued practice, and when his mind is released, at least temporary, so he maintains it. He understands, he has a experiential knowledge that when fair amount of morality is available, and on top of that, when there is fair amount of concentration, and when that concentration being used to investigate, mind develops wisdom, and when that wisdom comes to a kind of a threshold or complete to some extent, then the mind let go of all graspings and mind get released. So he time to time experience this temporary release. So he experienced this temporary release, and this temporary release he understand as a kind of a foundation, as a reference for his own practice. So it's a matter of maximizing this temporary release now. How to expand it, how to maximize it, how to prolong it, how to establish it. So that result become path in a way. So you got some result through your own practice, and it's a matter of cultivating that result, prolonging that result, maintaining that result, sustaining that result. So in order to do that, you need some morality, you need some amount of concentration, clarity of mind, and again you need to uproot various defilements which are the ones disturbing this release. So these, in a way we can say, are the anudhammachari particularly. So that one is live according to the dhamma. Dhammesu nichyam anudhammachari. So always now he is trying to live according to the dhamma. He understand how much operating and what are the qualities, spiritual qualities that are currently present and how they are operating. And so likewise he is now living according to the dhamma. This is particularly the dhamma practical sense. Adinavam sammasita bhavesu. So he doesn't want to become anyone, doesn't want to become a kind of a, say a celestial being, a Brahma or whatever it is, or else he doesn't want to promote any bhava tanha, desire to become. Rather, at the present moment, he is quite contented. He doesn't have any burning kind of a frustration. So when we are not contented with the present moment, we have some sort of a frustration. Always something is missing. I want that. I want to become that. I want to have the promotion. I want to become a billionaire or whatever it is. So you always have that kind of a desire-driven situation. So, but when you are free from that desire to become, so one is internally happy, internally satisfied, internally quenched, we can say. So your thirst has disappeared. So this is something that Buddha highlighted, where the thirst of craving is not operating in one's mind. Mind is in a kind of a quenched situation, calm situation, not in a burning situation, but in a very contented, calm, peaceful situation. And when one associates such situation, he understands the danger or the burning or the frustration or the suffering one may go through when desire is available, or when kind of a burning desire is available, when such desire is trying to push, trying to operate, or try to dictate us, or try to take us as a victim, a slave. So one understands that danger. As a result of that, he is trying to keep away all these different kinds of cravings. Eko chare kaggavisana kappo. So one lives alone like a rhinoceros horn, because one reflects about one's own mind. So it's a kind of a practice that one has to practice by oneself. So your parents, your children, your husband, your wife, your friends can't do it for you. So you alone has to practice. You alone has to develop it. You alone has to do the investigation. So therefore, one lives alone like a rhinoceros horn. You may be living with others, but you have your own practice to continue. So with that, I like to conclude today's Dhamma sermon. Now I like to open the session for questions.
Sir Ayamante, I will be reading the questions as we wait for Chatur to join. Currently, we have eight questions. First question. Dear Venerable Sir, this report is on one aspect of my walking practice related to the distractions from the primary object and coming back. Much merits for your guidance and teaching during the last year, and we are fortunate to participate in this program. I start my walking practice focusing on the soles of the foot and observe various sensations such as difference of pressure on the soles, soft and hard parts, hot and cold patches, etc. And sometimes the full walking process as pedaling a cycle. After 10 to 15 minutes of continuous mindful walking, these sensations start to fade away, and I observe that the mind gets distracted to thoughts or sounds time to time. Based on Venerable's advice, about 6 months back, I started looking at these distractions more closely and mindfully. During the initial period, I realized the status after some time missing a few rounds of the walking path. While distracted, I try to understand if I feel the sensations on the soles I am familiar with and observe that the mind comes back immediately and align with the walking process. It took me a few months to get a gauge of the effort I am putting into bringing the mind back to align with the walking process. After many sessions and based on your guidance, I deliberately reduced this effort. Eventually, just a gentle realization of not being with the walking process was enough to slowly bring back my mind. If I don't put any effort to bring the mind back to the walking process, I can still stay with a thought or sound and be mindful on that observation. When the effort is minimum and optimal, I feel very relaxed and calm throughout the time, irrespective of where I am with the walking process or distraction. The whole experience feels like moving from one object to the other very gently without altering the beam of mindfulness. Thought of writing this reflection and thank you for your valuable guidance with metta. That's the end of the question.
Yeah, actually now when you are confident that now I am capable of maintaining my attention irrespective of walking, I can maintain my attention on other distraction as well. Now this is the time to practice that. Actually, the walking meditation helps as a guidance for that, as a, say, mula kamatahana, the primary object for achieve this developed mindfulness. And once we reach fair amount of mindfulness, now it is not necessary to have only a selected object. Rather, you can be mindful at anything. So when you are mindful on anything, you know that you are experiencing this. You know, I am experiencing that. So likewise, so in order to maintain mindfulness, it is not a must to have a certain selected process, but you can be mindful on different processes. It may be sounds, it may be sights, it may be smells, it may be taste, it may be tactile sensations, it may be what you are experiencing, that is also the touching through the walking. So different areas now you can include to your practice, and that is in a way the broadening of your practice. So therefore you don't need to return back to walking now quickly, but you can start with walking, of course, and once you gain fair amount of mindfulness, you can see how mind is operating. You can allow mind to wander a little, you can relax your effort and see how mind is behaving. So now mind switch to a particular distraction, but you know you are there. You are not a victim of that distraction. You are not thinking about that distraction. You are not promoting any sort of mental proliferation about that distraction, but you know you are fully aware. Okay, mind is right now observing a sound. Mind is right now experiencing a thought. Mind is right now observing, say, a kind of say sight. So likewise, so you are quite mindfully you do that activity. So therefore what you have experienced is quite correct and quite good, and now you don't need to quickly return back to walking, but now you can do a little bit of a play, a little bit of investigation to this new experience. So what is really happening in this external phenomena? What is sound? How sounds behave? What are these sights? How mind operates when going through a sight, when going through a smell, when going through another taste? So likewise, so it's a matter of expanding your understanding, exploring your understanding. So that broadens your understanding. So therefore, you can continue like this, no harm. But in a particular situation, if you feel that you are not confident, and you are losing mindfulness, you start to start thinking, proliferating, then better come back to walking again. Right.
Next question. This is a general question. Dear Bhante, many of us experience in the practice at least a glimpse of the non-attached awareness due to mindfulness without any object after a few months of continuous practice. Bhante explains often that these states need to be improved, and our duty is to practice as much as possible and apply mindfulness to day-to-day activities, and there will be a transformation without us needing to do anything specific. We have heard from other school of thought that taking non-attached awareness as existing or a thing is wrong and will not take us beyond it, and there should be a profound understanding first in order to follow the path of practice correctly. Appreciate if Bhante can explain a bit and give us some clues to resolve these conflicting ideas with metta. That's the end of the question.
Actually, I have to agree with the second statement, because I also don't think that you can maintain this unattached state of mind without having a proper understanding. Because that is why we do a lot of observation. Say we are observing various thoughts, we are observing various feelings, we observe the bodily behaviors, we observe various bodily phenomena. So this observation is the one improving our understanding. So that is the base in a way. So understanding that these things are impermanent, these things are unsatisfactory, there is nothing substantial here, there is no essence or core. So this is the kind of a strong understanding one needs to have. Then based on that understanding, one is able to, or rather one's mind is able to let go of. So Buddha very clearly mentioned, so this understanding, clear knowing, is something helps to minimize grasping. Because we start grasping, we start attaching to things, because we have certain perversions in the mind. So we think, okay, this is pretty good, this is very beautiful, and this will give me enough satisfaction, and this is permanent. So this is mine, this is myself, this belongs to me, this is what I am. So likewise, we have different perversions, wrong understandings. So through one's insight practice, one is in a way reducing these defilements or these wrong understandings. One is eliminating wrong understandings. So when one has proper understanding, so that helps to free, or that helps to let go of these grasping. So that letting go and that release has a fair amount of wisdom, and that is the release that we have to highlight in a way. That is the release that we can say is long lasting, and that is the release that we need to prolong, that we need to maximize. So therefore, so when one develops that, so it becomes one's nature in a way, and you are able to look at it more in a natural sense rather than going through a lot of practice. And even though at the beginning you are doing a lot of practice, but later as you are able to continue your practice and being more familiarized with these release states, so then slowly it becomes one's nature. So the doing part becomes less and less. So you don't need to struggle now. You don't need to do a lot of things now. So actually you need to put yourself quickly to that release state and see whether you can maintain it. Most of the time you can't actually, because again and again mind go and grasp. So that very grasping helps us to understand further defilements, and then to eliminate those defilements or to weaken those defilements. So when further defilements are weakened, then you can maintain that release state longer. So likewise, it's a kind of a practical situation. So you have something to do at the beginning, you are doing a lot of observation and understanding, you are enhancing your understanding, so that helps to release. And then that release has to be prolonged, release has to be cultivated.
Avasarai Bhante, question number 3 of 8. This is a general question. We have heard stories about many noble people arriving. We have heard stories about many people arriving with their respective status while engaged in the outside world. Is there any specific reason or favorable factors for realizing Dhamma and attaining the liberation while engaging with the outside world? With metta, that's the end of the question.
Actually, Buddha explains not only the internal phenomena, but also the external phenomena. Say, so when you are practicing, you don't need to limit yourself only to the internal practice. Say you are observing your breath, or you are observing your different element characteristics, different feelings. So this is, you can say, fairly, one is keeping more attention to the internal phenomena. This is not limited to that. So you can observe various outside phenomena as well. So when different sounds happen outside, you can observe how they start to cease. When certain, say, kind of a smell happens, you can observe how it is slowly decreasing. When sometimes when your concentration mindfulness is very sharp, probably you can even observe how certain sights, whether they appear like still or are they sort of dissolving, disintegrating. So certain people have that kind of a very sharp mindfulness and concentration, and they are able to even see how certain outside phenomena, how they even disintegrate. So therefore, both are possible. So actually, even today morning, I conducted the Sinhala Dhamma sermon on the Mahasunyata Sutta. So there are Buddha highlights that one is trying to attain emptiness using internal phenomena. Again, one is trying to attain emptiness using external phenomena. And one is trying to attain emptiness using both internal and external phenomena. So these are different practices available. So therefore, for Vipassana, there is no limit. There is no any particular boundary mentioning only these phenomena are to be applied. So whatever the internal and external phenomena, and most of them are conditioned phenomena, they are constructed phenomena, they have happened due to various reasons, causes, and those all are capable of using for one's practice as raw material for one's practice.
Question number, I think it's 4 of 8, general question. Dear Bhante, where can I find the book written by Matarishi Swaminvansa on Vidarshana Parapura with Metta?
Yes. I think I'm not sure whether it is available in our website. Maybe not, because actually it was not Vidarshana Parapura. You can see whether it is available in the in our website, Nisanwani website. Let me see. Seems not available. Yeah, it is not available. We'll see, because that is some interesting book published by Most Renewable Matarishi Jnanarama Mahathero, because he did a lot of investigations, or he did a lot of explorations about different Vipassana traditions, and therefore this is the early levels of our Dharmavane. So he was the teacher, the founding teacher, and he did a lot of investigations to various ancient paths available in Sri Lanka. And he published a book called Vipassana Parapura. So those different generations are not in detail. So we'll see whether we are able to make it available as a soft copy. And if it is available, probably we can put it to our website. Currently, it is not available as a soft copy.
Question number 5 of 8. Also on another monk. Dear, how did the great Katukurunda Nanananda Thera, who wrote Nivana Nivima, passed away? How old was he when he passed away? Have you met him when he was alive? And have you spoken to him? Great appreciation and merits with metta. That's the end of the question.
Yeah, actually I met him several times. Actually my first encountering Most Venerable Katukurunda Jnananda Mahathera was even before I come to Nisarnavane, because while I was in Navayana, I get to know about his books, and I started to read them and started to listen to Nivane Nivima, this great 33 discourses. And maybe it's in 2012 or something, 2013 or 2012. So at that time, I was fortunate to visit him when he was in Pahankanwa. I met him. I had a good discussion with him. And later, after coming to Nisarnavane, I got the opportunity back again to meet him at several locations. So a group of monks, we went to meet Katurunde Mahathero and have a very good Dhamma discussion. To that, I was able to participate. And another occasion, I have visited him with few other friends. I was again was able to participate in the discussion. So likewise, I was fortunate enough to have good discussions with him. I really admire those discussions. And he really helped me to have a good understanding about the Dhamma, about the practice. And again, I can't exactly remember, by the way, how old he was when he was passing away. Maybe around 75 years. I can't exactly remember what was the age when he was passing away.
Question number 6 of 8. General question. Dear Bhante, could you please explain Kaya Viveka, Chitta Viveka, Upadhi Viveka? That's the end of the question.
Yeah, I briefly explained that Kaya Viveka is the bodily seclusion where you have kind of a resting time away from the typical gathering of the other people. Say when you are with the group, when you are having a company with others, you don't have the bodily seclusion. So when you have bodily seclusion, that means that you are a little alone. But the point is, even when you are alone, your mind may not be alone. Your mind is not really maintaining solitude. Your mind may go through various defilements, various, say, hindrances. So that is another area, therefore, we need to look at. That is important, that is mentioned as Chitta Viveka, where you are keeping your mind free from hindrances. So in order to do that, you need to develop some amount of concentration. So different samatha practices are helpful to achieve this Chitta Viveka. But the most important thing is the Upadhi Viveka, where one is able to eradicate various defilements, particularly the eye making, mind making. So how we prepare kind of an ego, kind of a self. So these are the roots of the suffering. So the Upadhi Viveka talks about having freedom from those kinds of defilements, deeply rooted defilements. So that is the Upadhi Viveka. Then one can say, oh, the mind is completely free. One is free from defilements. One's mind is having a seclusion from defilements, from attachments, from those assets that we call as me, mine, myself. So then what we call as the enlightenment, Buddha explained, and that is the important thing Buddha highlights, and that is the Upadhi Viveka. So the last two, that is Chitta Viveka and Upadhi Viveka, are the most important things. And for that, to some extent, Kaya Viveka is also important.
Question number 7 of 8. This is also maybe like a follow-up question from the last one. Can you please explain a little bit more about Upadhi Viveka? How do we know if we need to have or already have this quality in our life? With metta, that's the end of the question.
Actually, the Upadhi means assets. So assets. So now suppose you are going from one country to another country. So what do you carry? Saying while being in Sri Lanka, say you are able to obtain upadhi. So that is the term upadhi, what you call a degree. You are able to experience, sort of gain some experience through your, say, job. So this is your kind of accountable experience. And you have your house, you have your children, your wife, your husband, and your designation, your reputation, and all these things are assets for us. So we consider them as assets. And even if you go to another country, so you identify yourself using these assets. So this is how you explain yourself. I am a so-and-so. I had this kind of a degree. I had this kind of a education. I lived in this country. My nation is this. My country is this. And my designation was this. My title is this. My salary is this. So likewise, we are using various skills, our achievements, many things as assets to define ourselves. But the problem is, all this helps to make a self. All this helps to prepare a self. All this helps to affirm a self. So that is the issue. So as one develops in vipassana, one needs to understand how this kind of a self-affirmative thoughts happening. Suppose time to time, mind start to remember how you did something, how you completed a particular task, how some others have praised you, how others have even blamed you, how others have criticized you, or how others have sort of put you on a pedestal. So likewise, so all these different situations are there to promote a self, self-affirmative thoughts. So if one is careful, one is, one's mindfulness and wisdom is quite, sharp, one is able to catch these thoughts. Buddha refers the terms eye-making and mind-making. Ahankara, mamankara. Ahankara means eye-making. Mamankara means mind-making. So we always have I. So I want to become an I. I want to become someone. So these are myself, my things, my children, my wife, my husband, my office. So these thoughts actually helps to sustain that a person in ourselves. Sustain or maintain a particular personality in ourselves. So these are the kind of things what we call as assets, which are helping to maintain a person, maintain I. So in deep vipassana, so one can recognize these thoughts and one can disclaim them without affirming them. One can letting go those thoughts without promoting them. So you are not promoting those self-affirmative thoughts. Rather, you recognize them as delusive thoughts, ignorant thoughts. And trying to keep the mind free from self-affirmation. Trying to keep the mind free from such attachments. Say, for example, so mind is there, awareness is there, that's it. There is no eye-making, there is no mind-making. So the point, another important point is that it is a self-created or mind-made self what we have. It is not a really existing self what we have, rather what we have is a mind-made self. So more we understand this mind-made self, so one may understand it's what a illusory thing that we are going through. What a kind of ignorant thing that we were doing. So we were always making a self, always making a person, and that delusion has to be sustained. So we are struggling to sustain that delusion. This delusion of self, to maintain that delusion of self. So it's a struggle. Because it's a delusory thing. It's a mind-made thing. It's not a real thing. So this is something that one needs to continue in one's practice, particularly in the, say, when one reaches fair understanding about vipassana. So that helps to little dilute the self, not to have a big ego, not to have a very selfish kind of an attitude. So one maintain one's whatever the activities, your job and whatever the household activities. So that you may continue, but without much burning, without much of a fight with another person. But on the other hand, I like to add another point here, because sometimes, so when we are going through this kind of practice, it's difficult to maintain kind of a personality. So that sometimes it is useful to have in your job, in your career. Suppose you are a person engaged with some administrative activities. On such situation, you need to have a certain amount of personality. Otherwise, you can't do the administration. So how to do a kind of a balance here? These are certain kind of challenging situations. So the practice helps us to understand there is no person, no being, no self, no individual here. At the same time, certain activities requires the presence of a self, presence of a strong personality. So this is actually being discussed sometimes in the Dhamma. So Buddha therefore refers that certain even Arahants, so they refer, I made the Dhamma sermon. He referred me. I did this. So likewise, Arahants also refer using personality, using I. But the important thing is Buddha mentioned, but they are using it knowing that it's a convention. They are not trapped in that convention. So they know wise usage of that. They know the practical usage of that. That's all. They are not trapped in that kind of a usage. Yeah.
Question number 8 is the last one, Bhante. Do we have time? Because we got a little bit over. Yeah. Is that okay? All right. General question. Bhante, after establishing good awareness, I would like to use it for Nibbana. Is it breaking Samma Ajiva if I have established awareness to a high level and then without any choice having to use for worldly stuff? Or should I take a drastic shift and make a decision to come out of lay life? That's the end of the question.
Yeah, that's what I was mentioning. Either you lead a lay life or either you will need a monk's life. So you need to practice. So if you are able to find out time and you got some good guidance and you got some opportunity to practice, so you can continue your practice. So even because what the point is, there are monks who really practice and there are monks who are not really practicing. So both are there. So sometimes, I mean, certain pitfalls are there in the monk's life. So when one becomes a monk, certain training is required. So you have to have kind of a humble attitude. You have to go through certain introductory sessions, and people start to venerate you. So sometimes the conceit may grow. You become a person. So likewise, I mean, different challenges are also there in the monk's life. On the other hand, the lay life, other types of challenges are there. So, I mean, so both are available, both opportunities are available. So therefore, some people are capable of developing mindfulness and developing spiritual practice while being a lay person. Some people are able to develop spiritual practice being a monk. And some people are not in all both the situations. While being a lay person, he is not capable of practicing. And while being a monk, certain person is not capable of practicing. So these are actually person dependent in a way. We can't give a definite answer to everyone. Okay, you all have to become monks, otherwise you can't practice. There is no such kind of a definite answer we can't give. Actually, Buddha didn't give that kind of an answer. Buddha had lay followers as well as the ordained followers. So both were there, and for lay people, the practice is available, and therefore it is also possible to continue one's practice as a lay person.
That ends the questions for today, Bhante. So I'd like to finish up. Firstly, by thanking Bhante for giving up all this valuable knowledge and time for this program and this practice, and also to pass on any merits that we've accrued together to everyone seen and unseen, and also to the people working behind the scenes who you may not see to make this program a success, and lastly to the participants, because without you we could not go ahead. So with that, I'd like to end the program. Tero Ansanai.
Yeah, Tero Ansanai. Sukhi Hoto.